Recently, here at the centre, I was interviewing a well-known Scottish poet, the poet Don Paterson. A very interesting man, a very gifted poet. He's probably one of the best poets writing, I think, at the moment. Yeah, he's really, really good. I'd recommend his poems. And I was interviewing him. This is part of poetry, so I was interviewing him here in front in the shrine room. And interestingly, he's very influenced by Buddhism. In one interview with him, he was even saying, I believe in the truths of Buddhism. So I, of course, then said, well, why aren't you a Buddhist then? And he made some sort of slightly evasive response. My Jeremy Paxman moment. We all have one. One of the things that he was saying a lot, and what he often talks about in his books, he's just recently written a book on Shakespeare's sonnets, and he's keen to quote this phrase, and I think it's an old song called "There Ain't Anyone Here But Us Chickens." Yeah, I think it is an old song. I tried to look it up today. "Ain't anyone here but us chickens," and he quite often comes back to that. He's trying to say, "Look, there's no one here but us chickens." Yeah, and so my whole talk is just based on him saying, "There's no one here but us chickens." And of course, I was very struck by that comment. I quite liked it. It seems a very reasonable, very rational, very sensible thing to say. And what, of course, he's trying to say is there's no divine world. There's no supernatural world. There's no intervention. There's just us chickens here. There's no one working us. There's no one working through us. There's no divine agency. There's just us chickens. And you know, in his life, he was very influenced by Scottish Christianity, particularly a particular kind of it, and for a while was very devout and sort of rejected that. So he was very much wanting to say, look, anything that kind of asks for some sort of divine intervention, some sort of supernatural presence in life, is really just a kind of evasion. Interestingly, he extends that to his writing style. So when he writes about Shakespeare's sonnets, he doesn't take up the role of a scholar in a rather high-minded, sort of objective, slightly distant way. He just talks to you. So he makes jokes. He says, actually, I don't understand this poem. So-and-so says it means this, but I'm not a clue. It's really refreshing, actually. It's much nicer than the sort of rather scholarly approach that most people take to the sonnets. It makes Shakespeare very human, actually. And it's interesting because, again, what he's doing there, he's saying, look, there ain't anyone here but us chickens. So when I'm writing this book about the sonnets, I'm only talking to other chickens. I'm not talking from on high and, you know, that's just us. So I think it's a very useful idea, and I was rather taken with it. I tend to think slower than he does. In fact, I tend to think slower than quite a few people. It sort of stuck in my mind. And of course, gradually, as you think about that phrase and all that phrase comes to mean, no divine agency, no supernatural power, no other world, just this world, and our lives must be lived in this world, all of which seems eminently sensible. And he's even interpolated Buddhism into that, which I think he's understood as meaning Buddhism saying you've only got this world and this life, and so the thing to do in this world and this life is to pay attention to the present moment, because that's all you've got. That obviously seems him as eminently sensible. I'm not actually sure it's a Buddhist idea, but that's what he thought it was. So that's what he thought what Buddhism was saying is, no one here but us chickens, but tell you what, Buddhism's really good at telling you how to live well as chickens. And how you live well as chickens, folks, just in case you need to know, is you pay attention. And you especially pay attention to the present moment, because that's all you've got, that's all you really experience. So the only way to live is to be in the present moment, because there's no one here but us chickens. So there you go, yeah. Eminently sensible, modern, intelligent point of view, which I have a lot of sympathy for. But of course, the more I thought about it, the more I thought there were problems in it. So that my first question was, how do you know? I mean, I should have said that. I should have said, how do you know there's no one here but us chickens? You know, you say it and it sounds rather sophisticated and real and, you know, in touch. But actually, it's a belief. You don't know that there's no one here but us chickens. There's, you know, evidence doesn't show up anything else, but you don't actually know that. I know people who've had experiences that suggest that there are other things here but us chickens. People whose honesty, veracity, integrity, sense, good sense and sanity, I have no reason to doubt. But they've experienced things that suggest that the idea that there's nobody here but us chickens is far too limited. I've actually only had a few of those kind of experiences. I rather hoped I'd be the kind of visionary kind. It's a real shame, actually. I'm still hoping, actually. I come from the Midlands, and I don't think you get Midlands visionaries. So I blame it entirely on the location of my birth. But on the first retreat I went on, I was meditating, and I had a vision of Christ on the cross. It's a bit confusing on a Buddhist retreat. And I'm not even a Catholic, so... And afterwards, I think I actually did that. You know, I sort of made it happen in some way because I needed to have a deep experience, and the one I could come up with, rather confusingly, was Christ on the cross. So if you don't have visions, folk, don't worry about it, and don't bother with Christ on the cross. But some of my friends do have more visionary experiences. Some people I talk to on newcomers' retreats have them. I was just talking to a woman order member in Croydon just now. And I said, oh, why did you come along? She said, oh, I don't know, when I was 17, I was cycling home from work, and this was near Croydon, and she said, the skies just seemed particularly beautiful, and I suddenly realised that we were all interconnected. She said, I didn't have those words then, but I had this very deep intuition at 17, and interestingly, she said to me that when she was 7, she insisted to her parents to become vegetarian. She just said she just felt intrinsically disgusted with eating meat, which again I thought was very interesting. But she said she was cycling on when she said she saw the evening sky, had this feeling immediately that everything was interconnected and everything in at a certain level was just fine, was perfect. And she said it came and went really, really quickly, but she knew immediately that she could never live an ordinary life, just from that experience when she was 17. She said she just immediately knew that from then on she could never live an ordinary life. She should never go back to what was given. You know? And she said it actually took her a long time to get involved in Buddhism. She wasn't interested in Buddhism, she wasn't interested in religion, but she was very interested in this experience and what this experience might mean. Yeah? So not only are friends that I meet, people I look up to whose honesty, integrity I can't doubt, have experiences that seem to suggest there's more here than us chickens, also, newcomers come along and have those experiences. They're quite common, they're not uncommon. Some of them are quite incredible. As I say, I haven't ever met you that I'd like myself. But also, Buddhist tradition has always assumed that there's much more here than us chickens. So the Buddhist tradition suggests that, I will get onto images eventually, folks, but it might take a long while, that the universe is arranged that it infinitely extends horizontally. So from where we are now, the Buddhist vision of the world is that there are different world systems with different creatures on it, with different people, even people trying to practice the Dharma, except for they'd call it Rilagya or something in some strange tongue, as yet, if they have tongues, etc. But Buddhism's assumption is that the universe extends infinitely to infinite universes with living beings on. So it doesn't have this sort of universe-centric vision. But it also assumes that the world we live with is stacked vertically, that there are all kinds of beings that live in this sphere, but sort of at different levels. And religions have often tried to suggest this. It's like the hierarchy of angels in the ancient Catholic tradition. But a sense that there are beings that live on this, in this bit of the universe, but on different levels, sort of stacked, as it were. Buddhism has always assumed that. So, for instance, it's tended to assume that there's things like tree spirits and water spirits and mud spirits and a kind of gods. They're not gods like the Western gods. They're more like the Olympian gods. They're sort of, you know, it's just assumed that the universe is peopled, as it were, hierarchically, vertically. And of course lots of Buddhist commentators have wanted to say, well, they don't really mean that. that's just to do with their time. And I don't quite know what they might mean, but I think our tendency to want to dismiss that is part of our time, if you see what I mean. Again, there's enough suggestible evidence that people experience other kinds of life. So my first question I should have asked Don is, how do you know? And of course his real answer can only be, I don't know, that's what I believe. What I believe is that there's only us here, no one here but us chickens, and that's what I believe. So he's mistaken a belief for a fact. And that's what modern materialism does. It mistakes a belief for a fact. We've got so used to our belief that we think it's a fact. But actually it's just a belief. And just like belief in God is a belief, it's a belief. We don't actually know. In fact, we know very little indeed. Of course, the second thing I wanted to ask him, and perhaps the most important thing I should have said, is, Don, what are chickens? I mean, that's the really vital point, isn't it? So, okay, say there's no one here but us chickens. Just remind me, what are they again? What is a chicken? So let's remember that we're talking about us. What are we? So when we say there's no one here but us chickens, within that little phrase has an assumption that we know what chickens are. And probably what is buried in that phrase is that chickens are born from eggs, their consciousness arises on the dependence of their body, and they die and their consciousness dies. It's probably a basically materialist assumption, isn't it? That all you've got is human life, or chicken life, that arises out of various biological chemical processes, life comes together, consciousness appears as a kind of epiphenomena of the brain. You've got this complex bit of physical being, and out of that, in this mysterious way, we've created all this. I mean, that's still in philosophy supposed to be the hard problem of how matter makes this, how that grey thing in my head creates this, how your life, how my life, is created by this thing in my skull. It's called the hard problem. Nobody can deal with that. How do you get from a thing to all of this? Yeah. But the assumption is that consciousness is an epiphenomena. In other words, it just is a kind of almost a byproduct of the thing. And that when the thing dies, consciousness dies. Yeah. It's basically a materialist assumption. And it's one that we're so used to, we think it's true. It's actually a belief, and we don't know. We don't know what happens when you die. I don't know, and tell you what, folks, nor do you. And we easily think we don't know, but we underneath that think we do, and we think what happens when you die is you die. And what that means is everything about you is obliterated. Yeah? We don't know that we think that, and we don't realise that's a belief. Do you see what I mean? But that is our common sense assumption. It hasn't always been. If we were to be now transported into time 200 years in the past, we would all believe in God. And that would be our commonplace assumption. So that if you started to say, well, I'm not sure that God exists, people would think you were mad, even criminally insane. And they did at first. They really thought, this person is mad and dangerous, that they don't believe in God. It's self-evident that God exists. Who made all this, do you think? Any thoughts? You know what I mean? So if you don't get that, you must be barking. You know what I mean? It's just that we've got so used to getting rid of God that we don't realise that we've just got a new idea. And this is, in a way, the great movement of the 20th century and the 21st century, is Nietzsche's famous death of God, his departing from the universe, as it were, metaphorically speaking. And as he's departed from the universe, it's left us with this shattered hulk of nihilism and materialism. It's left us with, there's no one here but us chickens. Yeah? Which is underneath that phrase, and I think Don Passon means it more sceptically than it sounds, but I won't go into that. I think he is open to them being more, but I think he's very sceptical. Well, he talks of himself as a sceptic. And actually, Buddhism is very sceptical in a certain sort of way. So what you've got there is an underlying view that is so common to us, so shared amongst us, that we take it to be the facts of life. Even though we have experiences all the time that kind of contradict that, or at least seem to create other facts. So what you've got there is you've got this basic materialist assumption that what life exists in is us chickens, and us chickens are mere matter which have been created by other matter, the coming together of various bits of matter, and out of that matter a self has been born, and out of that physical sense a consciousness. It's a materialist worldview, and that's been expressed in the West primarily in terms of consumerism. People sometimes say that, mix up the two, materialism is the underlying philosophy, although that's probably too grand a term for most of us, and it's expressed in consumerism, which basically says, okay, if there's no one here but us chickens, the least we can do is enjoy ourselves. And what's that come to mean is to tell you what I can buy things. That's what I can do, yeah? So what we've got in the modern West now is a system that is based on a view which is that there's no one here but us chickens. So how about we go and, what do chickens buy? I don't know. kind of lovely little nesty things for their nests. Egg covers for their eggs and, you know, grooming things. You know, I don't know what chickens buy. I'm going to leave that to your imagination. So what we've got is a world in which the answer to our human situation is to buy things, then get dissatisfied, and then buy more things. That's what we've ended up with. That's our working result of materialism, is you buy things, get dissatisfied, and then you buy some more things. And the system that we're immersed in really understands that very deeply. It understands how quickly we just get dissatisfied, and when to catch us with iPad 5 or whatever it is, or when to catch us with Kindle Fire, or when to catch us with a new kind of mobile phone. Apparently you've got one now that you can will scan barcodes. So you go for a meal and a drink, and they bring the wine to your table. You like the wine, you scan it on your phone, and you get it delivered the next day. Well, of course they don't mention if you've paid for it. But soon they'll be just able to scan them on your phone. And just when we were getting bored, just when we were wondering whether buy things, get dissatisfied, buy things is really a good enough description of human life, we've got a phone now that you can scan your barcode in, you can get wine delivered the next day. And that's what technological progress has been doing, hasn't it? It's been keeping us unwittingly tied into a whole network of stuff. Fairly trivial stuff, which is incredibly difficult not to get involved in, not to get hooked up in, even if you're someone like me, a Buddhist, who's been practicing for 22 years. So I recently thought, I've been thinking for a while to get a Kindle. You think, no, I don't remember. Anyway, then, and you click onto Amazon, and you think, you add to basket, you know, and then all you need to do is that you can now buy it with one click. So there I get my Kindle. I really like it, actually, it's fantastic. But don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to guilt trip us all about, oh, we shouldn't buy things. Look, I've just bought a Kindle, folks. We can breathe. we can relax. And so, of course, I buy this Kindle, I think there's no way I'm going to buy books on it. What I'm going to do is I'm going to do to the Guggenheim Project, or whatever it's called, where you can download all these free books, fantastic. And I'm going to put all these Buddhist sutras that you can put on for free. Really, really good thing, yeah? I haven't put any of them on yet, but anyway, it's a really good thing. So I thought, I'm definitely not going to buy any books. So I'm sitting on a balcony, reading my Kindle in full sunlight, as it said. And then I put press menu, and it says go to shop. I think, well, there's nothing wrong with going to the shop, is there? You know? You know, nobody can blame me for going to shop, so I press go to shop. And it presents me with a book I'm particularly keen on reading. That's nice, isn't it? You know? And I think, well, I'm not going to buy it. It's just ridiculous. I've told myself not to buy it. And then it says, read sample. I can read a sample. I mean, if I was in a bookshop, I could read a sample. So there I go. I press read sample, which is about 8 pages long. Read this sample. And surprise, surprise, at the end, all of my restraint is completely destroyed. I just buy with one click. I mean, you just do that. I mean, I bought a book on a balcony reading in the sun. Incredible. Just when I was getting bored. So that's what consumerism has done, is it's keeping us, isn't it, in that state of, okay, I buy something, I start to get dissatisfied, I'll buy something again. I start to get dissatisfied, I'll buy something again. It keeps us on a level. And it's a level predicated by materialism. Because it's basically underneath that saying, what else is there to do? There ain't anyone here but us chickens. All you get in this life is chicken life. So how about you have the best possible chicken life, and that's to buy things, yeah? And it's backed up, isn't it, by images. We finally got to images. So we've got the... We're in the midst of a storm of images. We've never, in all human history probably, been subject to so many images. I mean, it's incredible now, the amount of images that human beings now take in. Once upon a time, seeing something, an image, a painting, you only would see them in church, probably, mostly, certainly in Catholic countries, until fairly recently in human life, the image was a very rare thing and must have been a remarkable thing to go into, I don't know, the Scrivengini chapel in Padua and see the Giotto painting, which has been fantastic. Suddenly you're surrounded by the life of Christ, and it must have felt like you were with him. You know, it was a sort of early version of cinema, really. But now we're in the glut of images. We're in this incredible moment of information glut, image glut. And, of course, what those images are doing are backing up, emotionalizing our materialist assumptions. So mostly they're trying to get you to buy things or do things or go somewhere, which is basically always buying something. There are images of consumerism, but we don't think there's a consumerist image. They're just now the wallpaper of our life, constantly telling us, you know that feeling of dissatisfaction you've just got? Here's a way out of it. You know that feeling of dissatisfaction you've got? Here's a way out of it. So what we've got is really, effectively, religious images. Just like religious images, they're trying to get you to do something. They're trying to get you to believe something, including a belief in a materialist assumption. And they're trying to get you to act. Primarily, they're trying to get you to buy. So we're being manipulated all the time by images that keep on telling you the kind of life you should be leading. I keep on noticing these images of mobile phones, which seems to be little films of young people in strange top hats running around laughing and talking to mobile phones. It's sort of saying, that is the kind of life you should be having. Nobody can remember those images, perhaps a little while ago. But you know, we've got images that are sort of saying, here's your life, what your life should be like. They're images for the ideal. From a consumerist, materialist point of view, that you need to be beautiful, you need to be young, you need to be rich, you need to have a car, you need to have an iPad, you need to have this kind of life. They're images of satisfaction, images of fulfillment. They're often ravishingly beautiful, and they often use young, very beautiful people that have been improved in post-production, or whatever it is. So what we've got is we're surrounded by religious images. It's just that they're the images of the dominant religion of our time that has forgotten that it's a religion, has actually thought it's just a sensible response to the fact that there's no one here but us chickens. Yeah? So what we've got then in Buddhism is a whole other range of images. And those images in Buddhism are also trying to get you to believe something, trying to get you to feel something, trying to emotionalize views, attitudes, opinions, states of mind. They're even trying to get you to do something, just as the images that they're surrounded by. But of course, from my point of view, they're not distorted images. They're images for something that you can actually experience. Whereas images that suggest you should be young and rich, for many of us, are things that you can't ever experience, because you're too old, and you probably never will be rich. Yeah? So what we've got in Buddhism is, again, a whole other set of images. I mean, there's lots of other ways of talking about these images, but at the moment I just want to talk about them as images. Yeah? So this is our primary image in Buddhism, is the image of the Buddha. Some people have become Buddhists just by seeing this image. What images are trying to do is tell you everything at once. That's what an image is. That's why they say, you know, greater than 1,000 words or something. It's trying to get you to get the whole thing at once. And that's true of mobile phone adverts, holiday adverts, all the images we're bombarded by. They're trying to tell you, give you the whole thing at once, so that you act. Yeah? So this figure of the Buddha is trying to tell you everything about Buddhism at once. Yeah? And we've got these words like Buddhism, which in a way are they're kind of useful, but they're also confusing, potentially confusing. There's no word in Buddhism translated as Buddhism. Buddhism is a Western term, like Marxism and feminism. The traditional words we've got in Buddhism is the Dharma, which means many, many things, including the path to the truth. That's probably the best way. So what we've got here is an image for the path to the truth. And you know, you try to look at that image, and it tells you a lot about what this Dharma is. I mean, remember, when people met the Buddha, they weren't interested in Buddhism. Nobody came to the Buddha because they were interested in Buddhism. There was no such thing. They came to the Buddha because they'd heard that he had something and he could help them. So they were, I don't know, a prostitute came to the Buddha, a serial killer came to talk to the Buddha. All sorts of people, farmers, labourers, kings, came to the Buddha because they had real life issues, grief, pain, what's their life about. They came to the Buddha because they heard that he could help them. They didn't come to him because they were interested in Buddhism. Nobody probably spoke to the Buddha because they were interested in Buddhism. So what we've got here is an image for the goal. The Buddha's, this figure is saying, this is the kind of life you really want. You don't want to be this thing about running around with mobile phones or your Apple iPad or whatever it is. Actually, this is really what you want, isn't it? You want this kind of majesty, this kind of ease, this kind of integration, this kind of integral sense, this kind of, in this lovely enfolded sense, this so stable, calm, rich sense. It's a shame the way they're always covered with gold to represent the inner riches of the figure. But sometimes that can again make you think that it's something else, somebody else. But this image of the Buddha is really an image for the whole thing. So it's, people sort of say to me, I'm not interested in Buddhism, or I don't know about Buddhism, I'm not interested in religion. In a way, all of that misses the point. We're trying to create here at the centre a place where you can come and meet this figure. And you can meet people who are trying to, in their own very imperfect way, be a bit more like this figure. Use this image as their ideal, rather than the images of our contemporary religion of consumerism. Use this figure as their guiding light, their star, as it were. Try to be more like that. So it says, okay, well, meditation's part of that. Contentment's part of that. A kind of inner calm is part of that. It seems to me to be a figure we particularly need in the modern West. But of course, every image communicates something, and it can be misread slightly. The Buddha image has become the central image in Buddhism, in the Buddha's Dharma. It's this image that you see all the way around the world in lots of different ways, but this is the central image of Buddhism. But what you've got in the development of Buddhism is a veritable explosion of images. Every time Buddhism's gone to a new culture, after a certain time you've got an explosion of images, whether that's Japan, China, Tibet especially. You get an explosion of images. You also get non-images. You also get a tradition of not wanting to use images. So what we've got here in Padmasambhava, and I wanted to talk about him because we've got Padmasambhava Day coming on Sunday. What we've got here is another image. Perhaps at the end, come up and have a look. It's a very beautiful image. It's a Tibetan image, or at least it comes from the Tibetan tradition. And it's best to think of Padmasambhava as another way of creating this image. We recently did a retreat, Jonavacha and I had a retreat, in which we had this shrine to the Buddha, And then we went out and did we went around the grounds and did this kind of ritual dedication to the retreat, so that we really decided to be on this retreat rather than just sort of checking out in our mind. And what happened is that we started with this image, and then when we walked around the grounds, it was changed to Padmasambhava. So it was like this image suddenly became this image in front of it. And then at the end, it went back to the Buddha. And what that communicated to me is, don't fix images too much. This image of the Buddha is constantly capable of changing. In fact, it's always changing. Eventually there'll be a Western image, a fully Western image. That won't be for many hundreds of years, probably. But as Buddhism, what we call Buddhism, what's better to call the path of truth, really affects Western society and its views, for instance, affects its materialist views of there's no one here but us chickens, we'll end up with new images, as yet unimaginable images. And this image changes into this image of Padmasambhava. And one way of thinking about this image is it's the corrective in our modern world for our potential misunderstandings of this image. Yeah. So one of the things I notice with people getting involved in meditation Buddhism, some people want to think of it, want to think of this thing we call in the West Buddhism, or what we is better called the Dharma, want to think of it primarily in terms of themselves. They want to think of it as a kind of extension to well-being classes, such as the ones we lead downstairs. They want to think of it as a way of, there's no one here but us chickens, but let's be happy, healthy, calm, relaxed chickens, rather than running around headless chickens, to keep on working that metaphor beyond its scope. But do you see what I mean? That you can think that Buddhism, again, is like Don, I think, did, that Buddhism is saying, yeah, we are, there's only us chickens, but let's be these really relaxed, really grounded, happy chickens. And that is true to some degree. Buddhism includes all that. And many people who come to Buddhism need more of that. One of the first goals in genuine spiritual practice is to become a more happy, healthy human being. An unneurotic, an undivided, happy, healthy human being, not sort of against yourself, not turned against yourself, not turned against your own drives, not necessarily acting them all out, but not neurotically divided from yourself. A sort of healthy human self-awareness. Yeah? But this image goes much further. So one of the things that can happen with this, the image of the Buddha, is it makes you think it's about meditation. It makes you think it's about something you do on your own with your eyes closed. It makes you think it's a private thing. It makes you think it's something you do in your moments where you get to chill out, you get to sit in front of your shrine and have a relaxing moment. And I don't want to sort of pejoratize that, because it includes that. But this figure, Padmasambhava, says actually, no, it's much more than that. So just when you think it looks like that, it looks like this. And one of the first things to say about that is stepping down. So that Padmasambhava isn't just sitting up in meditation, he's stepping down. So what you've got with this figure is a figure that's got one leg up in meditation, so he's all the time in the state of meditation. So he's all the time in that state of calm, of equilibrium, of integration, of a kind of majesty, of complete equipoise. But at the same time, he's constantly active. So the leg stepping down represents that he's constantly active. He's always doing things. And that's a very important corrective to our modern ideas of what the Buddha might mean. What it does is it brings back the Buddha's activity. That actually, when you read about the Buddha, he's an incredibly active man. It often says in Buddhist canons that I went to him and said. So he doesn't say, tell you what, I lived in the Buddhist centre and I waited for people to come to a class and I said, if it's all right if I mention Buddhism. It's just a lot of the sutras start and said, I went to him and said. So he just goes to somebody and say something. Yeah. So the Buddha... Buddhism, or the Dharma, is truth-seeking, is an active practice. It's not just a me practice, it's a me in relationship with you practice. In fact, it's just as much a me in relationship with you practice as it is a relationship with myself practice. And the figure exemplifies that still more, because unlike the Buddha figure that usually has half-closed eyes or closed eyes, Padmasambhava is looking directly at you. He looks at you directly, so much so that he's actually slightly frowning. So what you can get with a Buddha figure is it starts to get sweetened and sentimentalised, as if Buddhism is about having a nice, sweetened experience that's calm and kind and smiling and rather sweetened. Buddhism, again, does include genuine happiness and fulfilment. But Padmasambhava frowns at you. And I take that to mean that his gaze on you is so intense that it's slightly scorching. And that's my sense of it. It's like he looks at you with such awareness and kindness that it's slightly scorching. It burns off your triviality. It burns off your self-preoccupation. Your self-reference. There's a lovely story of Padmasambhava, where he gets to meet the king of Tibet. A wonderful story. There's this wonderful sort of cinematic scene of the king of Tibet walking in with all his entourage, his fantastically dressed entourage. This is Tibet, so you can imagine, draped in riches. And they come to meet this figure who's got a trident, a three-pronged trident. He's wearing all these kind of chaotic robes. The king of Tibet just thinks, okay, well, I'm the king of Tibet, and this is a Buddhist practitioner, so they need to bow. And the Padmasambhava just stands there and just says, no, I'm going to bow. The king won't bow to the Padmasambhava. What Padmasambhava does in this mythic story, he just points at the king and his entourage, and a flame comes out of his finger and burns all their clothes off. That'll teach you. It burns all the... And what that means, I think, is it says, to meet me, you have to step out of all that finery. You have to step out of all that status. You have to step out of all that worldly self-importance. You have to meet me directly, nakedly. And of course, they immediately bow to him. You can only meet the Buddha, you can only meet Padmasambhava, as an ordinary human being, as a naked human being, without your status, without your career, without your CV, without your wonderful intellectual apparatus. You need to meet me nakedly, honestly, and then we can talk. Yeah? So I think one way of starting to look at this figure, and perhaps you'll be coming on Sunday and explore this figure more, is that it's corrective to the great figure of the Buddha. That it's active, it's to do with you and me, it's to do with me in communication with you, it's radical, it's not of the world. So when Padmasambhava is met by the world, by worldly authority, by the system, by the state, he burns it. He burns it off. He scorches all that away to meet the ordinary human being. And he meets them directly and humanly, and he tries to say to them, there's more than just us chickens. I'll do.